Hello and welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 33. This week we're going to talk about agricultural subsidies and the business of big government. Today is November the 17th, 2014. We've got Eric Taylor, Chelsea Cummo, Kirk Pettis, and myself, Matt Winter. Let's do this.
All right. So, Kirk, this is something you were talking about last week, and kind of we got the idea based off of some thoughts that you had on kind of alcohol-based alternatives to oil and gas. Is that right?
Yes. There's a new documentary called The Pump out there.
When did that come out?
Like a month ago. It's in various select cities, kind of like Citizen 4.
Okay.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard a lot about it. And but
did you just did you hear about it and then just start researching the topic, or was it something you just wanted to see?
Yeah, it was something that I had no idea, but it's kind of a little off the topic of this specific podcast, I guess, because it's more about purely as an energy source versus the subsidies of the agriculture. But
okay.
And I just always figured corn was ethanol. I didn't know ethanol was fuel, an alcohol-based fuel, that it can be made out of anything besides any starchy, sugary plant that carbohydrates. So, but I'll get into that later.
Yeah, so I'm looking, it's called Pump. That's just what it's called.
Yep.
Pump the movie.
I look forward to seeing it someday.
Do you know the gist of it? I mean, what the whole point behind it is?
Yeah, well, you know how they have these new flex fuel vehicles out there? And I don't know. Well, the oil companies have put so much propaganda in ethanol, and I personally was always because of the propaganda, and I just thought ethanol was just BS. I didn't want it in my gas. And after so I challenged myself to go into and look into it because I had a fear of ethanol, and now I'm completely the opposite. Now I want more ethanol in that gas. I don't believe in the subsidizing the corn, and I don't believe in the corn should be used in the production of ethanol as the majority of it, but now completely switched. Because alcohol it's a higher octane, it burns cooler.
And, yeah, but what do you think should be used instead of corn?
Yeah, what crop? Like as opposed to corn itself?
Whatever's natural in the local area. I don't think energy should come from big conglomerate and industries, that alcohol can be produced anywhere.
Yeah, but
and
if we're talking,
so you have more co-op systems that can promote, that can utilize the community, and that and most vehicles would use a blend of actually gasoline and an alcohol-based substance.
Well, I'd be cautious about saying that you could just use anything, because there's got to be something that's more efficient to grow as a crop than other things.
Corn is a very inefficient crop in the first place, so that's why I don't think corn.
Well, I think
it's very energy intensive product to produce, so to utilize it as an energy in vehicles is not very smart. I mean, there's cactuses you can use.
Switchgrass.
Cattails from your marsh just down, you know, wherever you live in Minnesota has three times more alcohol producing substance in it than corn does. So there's all sorts of plant life that you can utilize. Corn, I mean, potatoes, certain grains, sugar beets, there's certain cactuses that can be utilized. Our general food waste can be utilized. Most of the waste that we produce as society can be converted back into alcohol. It's whatever it can ferment is pretty much you can produce alcohol out of. So,
yeah.
So do you think that it would be, you know, efficient for us to say, you know, is it like there are other cities that, unlike, you know, where I'm living, I just have recycling and garbage. I don't have compost. But are you saying that we could theoretically, you know, take our compost and then that would then go to making, you know, to producing ethanol?
Well, I'm thinking more on food manufacturers and restaurants. Like David Bloom, one of the producers of Pump, like when he started this project of making his own alcohol for cars, he went to a donut shop and got all their excess donuts and made his own fuel.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And so it's like all these little, I mean, you can use oil from restaurants to make fuel.
Well, that's the whole diesel point.
Well, either way, it's fine. I mean, you're going to need both kinds in the long run. But the whole point is to get rid of these huge conglomerates and pollution centers and spread it out. I mean, alcohol was what our first cars ran on. And they weren't run on oil and gas at the beginning. They were run on alcohol.
Really?
And up until World War II... And the prohibition
is really what
did it. No, that's why.
Hold on, Kirk, slow down. You're right. Telling me that like the Model T ran on alcohol.
Yes.
No, it didn't.
It did.
No, it's a multi-fuel car, and its primary fuel was gasoline.
Well, the primary fuel is alcohol, but you could use it was there was switches to be and dials to be able to go back and forth between gasoline and alcohol. That's why there was a multi-fuel car because alcohol was prevalent. Only in the cities you could get gasoline, but the reason why the Rockefeller bought up the oil companies and he funded the temperance movement, the women's temperance movement, to promote the prohibition. And once the government passed prohibition. Then alcohol production got put out of business. All farms throughout the entire country produce their own alcohol to run their own farm equipment. So when you were driving around and needed fuel, you'd stop at a local farm and buy alcohol from them. That's how it was back in the day. And we have no concept of the reality of how things used to be.
Well,
and because we all think that
that's all fine and
oil
good,
and
but
gas.
Yeah, but, that's all fine and good. I mean, obviously prohibition had an impact on the but the Model T definitely ran mostly on gasoline. Like, that's what the history says.
Well, it said it was capable of running on gas, kerosene, or ethanol.
Right.
And then, you know, the decreasing cost. This is Wikipedia right now. I'm going to be totally honest. It says gasoline, kerosene, or ethanol, although the decreasing cost of gasoline and later introduction of prohibition made ethanol an impractical fuel.
Impractical, illegal.
Well,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. You're going to get arrested. Yeah.
I mean, moonshine was what people made everywhere. They didn't refine it to make it into drinking. Ethanol is a very – you don't want to ever drink this alcohol.
So one thing we're saying, just for the sake of the conversation of what we're talking about right now, ethanol itself has less BTUs per gallon than gasoline does. It is higher octane, so a lot of like race car guys who are building drag cars, high turbocharged cars, use ethanol because it's a very cheap source of very high octane fuel. The higher the octane is, the harder it is for it to ignite. And the reason that's important is because a turbocharger is going to pressurize the air, and pressurizing air heats it up. So as long as you can have a higher octane fuel with the higher heat of compression, you don't get detonation and the whole thing doesn't go kablamo.
Well,
so,
you can also modify your vehicle. I mean,
the whole thing I was trying to say is it's less efficient to run ethanol than it is to run gasoline because it has less BTUs per gallon.
Yeah, I mean,
it literally has less energy per gallon.
I know this, but my point is, I don't know. It's very minimal. It's not like.
Kirk.
A huge 20-30%.
Kirk.
It's minimal, and especially by blending it with a little gas to make you be able to start your car in the winter is a viable alternative to where you don't need much gas. I mean, all right, let me just go through the huge propaganda.
It's 71% as much BTUs per gallon is gasoline.
Yeah, I mean, you notice, Kirk, and that's what I was going to say. You notice.
Look up what the professional race car drivers use.
Kirk.
I just told you why.
Yeah.
But they use a lot more of the fuel. They just pour tons of it into the engine. It's a good, cheap, high octane fuel, but it's not more efficient.
Right. Per gallon. What I've heard from people that modify their car, it's like $500 to modify your car right now. That's not flex fuel because what all you need is the only reason alcohol is hard to run in our current vehicles is because of the fuel injection because we don't have a carburetor anymore. So the fuel injection is all computer run, and the computer's set up for gasoline. So all you need is to adjust the computer, the fuel injection, and that's all you're doing is putting a new computer chip in there to be able to change the fuel injection to utilize alcohol. And then you need hotter spark plugs. Those two things are pretty much all you need for the car. The propaganda out there that it eats away your fuel lines and it wrecks gaskets and parts in your engine is total BS.
There's already 10% ethanol in most of the fuel in the country, so that
well,
make
30
sense.
Years ago, they used to make all these components, but because of the addition of alcohol into gasoline back in the day and just gasoline in general, it's by taking in water, would rust out the gas tanks and the gas lines. So they started to line them back 30 years ago in the 80s.
Okay.
So as soon as – so that's why ethanol does not damage your – it's actually – here's the point. So you said you're going to have less BTUs. Yes. And people that say they have modified their car said they got 1 gallon – 1 mile less per gallon.
Yeah, it's so a 30% decrease, though. It is a 30% decrease in
you're not
available energy.
But you're not going to get 30% less gas mileage.
Yes, you do.
Kirk, this is like my biggest hobby. I spend more time modifying cars than I do anything else. Just trust me on this one.
Do this. If you we don't have a lot of ethanol or E85 in Minnesota, but if you – I notice this the last few times I've gone out west, out to Montana. As you get into central North Dakota and westward, it's prevalent, and your gas mileage will go down by 25 to 35%. Happens the more ethanol or the E85 grade.
That said, so that, there's two things in effect there.
How much cheaper is it to produce alcohol than to produce gas?
But just hang on a second and let me clarify that because you are seeing that decrease only because your engine isn't optimized for that much alcohol.
Yes, sure. Exactly.
Kirk
that's
is
what
right,
Kirk would say.
But yeah. The fact still remains if you do something as far as E85, you're looking at about a 30% decrease in fuel mileage.
Let me go into it a little further here. So burning gasoline produces carbon. Alcohol produces no carbon. And hardly, it's like 98% pollution free. So you're getting rid of all the pollutions that gasoline, which is a very caustic entity. And so I just watched this YouTube video clip about this 2000 Tahoe that a person donated that just ran strictly on E85, put on over 100,000 miles on it. Then they totally disassembled it, took apart the engine. Ripped open the cut in half the catalytic converter. Catalytic converter looked brand frickin' new after 100,000 miles. The engine had normal wear because there's moving parts, but very little because there's still 15% gas, so there's very little carbon. The parts were looking so much better than what a similar engine that had gasoline. The alcohol makes your engine run smoother. And it runs it cooler. It'll triple the length of your engine.
Well, I don't think anyone here is arguing that, you know.
I would argue that last point you made, but everything else I wouldn't.
Who was it? Cummins Diesel's making an alcohol-based diesel engine that they say will go a million miles now.
So are we ready to go into the agricultural subsidies, or do you want to talk about
– Yeah, I didn't want to get into it right now. I want to tie this back into it later. But
because, you know, subsidies definitely play a role not when you're really talking about – well, they do play a role in – some would argue that
when you're talking about ethanol, that it's a specifically with corn, it's a cost negative technology because of the subsidies that farmers receive to produce the corn for ethanol. That actually costs more money to produce the corn than the amount of energy that is utilized or is put off by burning ethanol, which is a direct result of corn subsidies that farmers get.
I think part of that's also due to organizations like the Minnesota Corn Growers Association who lobby for that kind of thing.
Well, exactly. Especially, yeah, in outstate Minnesota. There's this region that we live in, in the western, southwestern part of the state, is among the most productive corn regions in the country. So that lobby's pretty substantial, and I was thinking about this during the last election cycle. A lot of Democrats retained their seats because of the fact that they were strong proponents of agricultural subsidies for the farmers in the area, and that's how they get elected too. I have a clip, 7.5 minutes, John Stossel clip that goes over farm subsidies. And if you guys want to stop it, just let me know. Otherwise, I'll stop it in various spots. And it kind of gives an overview of the whole subsidy situation. We can go from there.
Every year, politicians warn, if we want to guarantee America's food supply, we have to save the family farm. And to do that, they want your money.
Lawmakers in Washington have passed a new farm bill.
In 2008, Congress passed another $300 billion farm bill.
We cannot turn back, not with an economy to fix and farms to save.
Saving farms is what politicians promise that farm supports will do.
Now, how old is this cat?
It's a reason they do photo ops like this one. The president wouldn't talk to us about the farm bill. We contacted 69 members of Congress who voted for it, but couldn't get any of them to talk to us until finally Randy Kuhl of New York and Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas agreed to speak.
Family farms, small farms are important.
And I don't think we want anybody in this country to starve.
People would starve?
They go out of business and they'd be forced to move elsewhere and find different jobs.
Well, that's not starving, that's finding a different job.
But if they don't have a job, then they're going to starve.
Well, they're doing pretty well in Nebraska. Corn farmer Mike Korth gets subsidies. He'll take the money, he says, but he's against the farm bill.
It's a bad bill. In the end, if you take a bunch of money, it's like they grab the treasure chest, they open the door on it, and whoever can get the most out of it, you just run away with it.
Nebraska farmers are running away with a lot of your money. Home prices may have been falling in most of America, but farmland prices have been rising. Here they've shot up 77% in 4 years. Farm subsidies rarely go to poor people. The average farmer makes twice what the average American earns. Yet Nebraska politicians want more.
We need to get farmers a better safety net here.
If you're a politician from Nebraska and you want to get elected, Republican or Democrat, the way to do that is to say, I support farm subsidies.
Yes, that's a very important thing to our farmer is a subsidy.
They would lose dramatic population if the subsidies weren't there at all.
But despite the billions spent on subsidies, farm towns are smaller than ever. In Mike Korth's town, store after store is boarded up.
It's pretty sad. The school at one time had just short of 1,000 kids in it, and now we don't have 300.
It hasn't kept these small towns alive.
Well, I think it has. I'm from a small town of 72 people. I am, and I'm going to tell you, farm subsidies have helped that town.
After this interview, we researched his town. It was twice as big during the Depression. Population has dropped steadily ever since.
But this isn't working. Well, I think it is, actually.
More. You guys are on welfare.
Actually,
it's not working.
Actually, I disagree with that, because I think it is working.
Actually, a government study found that the more farm aid a county got, the more likely it was to lose population.
Wow.
Why would that be? Because subsidies make it harder for smaller farmers to compete. Economist Walter Williams.
This kind of goes into a couple of things. Kirk, you're talking about how there are alternatives to corn when talking about ethanol.
And this, Matt, I think you were talking about an idea for another podcast talking about GMOs or large corporate agricultural organizations that they have lobbying power to make sure subsidies stay in place.
Right. Yeah. I just like I said, the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. They're very powerful. They do a lot of lobbying. I remember even back when I was in high school. So we're talking early 2000s, late 90s. There were subsidies just starting to become a big deal, and they would come to these super mileage competitions that I was doing when I was in high school. Where you design and build these super high mileage, you know, in the 350 mile per gallon range vehicles, and you race them basically to get the highest mileage you can. And they had a huge presence at those events. I mean, they were advocating the daylights out of E85. They had a complete separate competition for E85. I mean, we would basically take the engine that we were given, shave the head on it, and then throw it all together and then go compete in the exact same chassis. And, you know, still be getting about the same mileage because of those vehicles were so efficient anyway, but that they were sponsoring even back then, and they're bigger now than they were then. So you know, they're still out there.
Well, and what's crazy to me is, you know, in addition to subsidizing farm operations, the idea that we're giving subsidies to people in order for them to not farm. You know, so here he's talking about, well, if we didn't give subsidies for people to farm, then, you know, everyone would starve. Well, we're paying people to not farm their land in order to control the prices of the crops.
That's also, that's covered later on in this clip as well.
Oh, I won't jump too far ahead then. But, yeah, that's just insane to me. The fact that we would pay someone to not be productive is just completely counterintuitive to what I would imagine. I mean, if we're talking about using our resources wisely.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about, you know, employing people's talents in a way that provides some sort of benefit to the world and to the economy. So.
But in this case, it provides benefit to the groups that are lobbying. You know, on behalf of their interests, right? If these farmers don't farm, it prevents any type of saturation from taking place in the market, which puts at least a floor underneath, you know, various commodity prices, which is in their best mm-hmm. interest, but not in the, you could argue not in the, it really isn't in the, in the interest of the greater good. But in that arena, you're always, you know, the individual or corporate interests are going to go for what serves them best, which in this case doesn't serve everyone else as well. So I'll go ahead and move on with this clip.
Farm subsidies go to very, very wealthy farmers, not the ma and pa farm. It's these huge agribusinesses that get the big subsidies.
Farmers like Maurice Wilder. He's been America's single biggest recipient of farm subsidies. He wouldn't let us take a picture of his jet, but here he is at one of his many homes. Wilder's estimated to be worth $500 million, but he still gets your help making ends meet.
Where is the limit where you say, you know what, you're big enough now, you can put your pants on by yourself?
How do rich farmers legally get subsidies? The Farm Bill does say
no payments to farmers who make more than $1.25 million a year.
Yeah, and I can guarantee you, any one of them guys, they've got accountants that can hide that income.
When you have a Farm Bill this size, this stretches almost 2 football fields, there are loopholes in here somewhere for a wealthy farmer to crawl through.
I don't blame anybody for taking it when it's there and available.
You're getting a handout.
Well, they're getting, you know, in a sense, it is a handout.
This is not a handout. Take it, and if you lose it, fine, walk away. Not at all.
It's not?
No, it's not.
Why isn't that a handout?
I don't term it a handout. I term it an investment.
But that's your money he's investing. And why? We don't need farm subsidies to have an ample food supply. I bet you didn't know that the growers of most crops don't get subsidies.
Growers of apples, bananas, broccoli, cabbage, cantaloupe, carrots, cauliflower, grapes, lemons, limes, lettuce, and dozens of other crops get no subsidies.
There's no cabbage crisis or pineapple panic. And yet, because big crops get subsidies like rice and corn, food costs more.
I'm not used to paying these prices.
Another reason prices are high is that farmers get paid for not farming.
You get a government payment on it, about $26,000.
More than $20,000 a year for not farming his land. Real estate agents even use farm payments to sell homes to non-farmers. Agents didn't want to say that on television, so our producer posed as a home buyer and brought along a video camera.
Do you have to farm it? Do you have to farm it to receive it?
No.
It's like a little bonus that you don't really have to do anything to get.
All these homes get government payments, though nothing's farmed here. The owner of this home collected $7,000.
Well, it's like offered to us.
She isn't exactly sure why.
I think it's a weird setup, but there's a lot of weird setups.
This is just a crazy system. It's left over from the 1930s, left over from the Depression, and it's a great example of how nothing is as permanent as a temporary government program.
And Kirk, yep. Kirk, this kind of goes into what you're talking about, positive law, where you accrue legislation over legislation over legislation, and it doesn't, you know, for the most part, it doesn't get deleted or taken out of the books. It's still there.
It gets deleted by getting replaced.
You know, would it be possible to have laws that, I mean, I've seen examples of maybe like tax cuts or different things that they get passed with the condition that they are temporary. I mean, do you think it'd be possible for us to get in more of a habit of saying, yes, we're going to pass this thing, but it's going to expire unless it gets voted in again, which would force the people to have to vote for it again years down the road? So when it no longer becomes applicable, that it would disappear.
Well, that's how I view all government should be. Every bit of government expenditure should be a one-time fee. Boom, it's done. Next time it's around, you got to debate the whole efficacy of the matter at hand again. And that, yeah, that society as general, if we're going to utilize our tax dollars for any social event that we want done, that, all right, yeah, well, we congrue this taxes and we spend it on that. Any system that's set up to be funded year after year after year, government should not be involved in.
Or there should be an expiration. That's something I actually haven't really thought of before, but on legislation, there should be, you know, why not have at least an expiration date to revote on, you know, on the measure? And that would,
exactly,
know, that would retire unneeded pieces of legislation.
Do you think it'd really retire anything?
Just like a carte blanche sunset on every.
Essentially, that's why we vote on November 4 all the time, is to go and fix the economy and fix our government, and nothing ever changes. It just all keeps growing.
But, sorry, Chelsea, I talked over you there.
Oh, no, that's okay. But the difference here being that, you know, we might vote for politicians, but this way, you know, it would let old laws that no longer apply just die because they're, you know, not applicable anymore, or programs that, you know, have been taken advantage of or inefficiently run. It would force people to come up with better plans. It would hold the politicians more accountable to have to readdress and to make the argument once again as to why this is a good idea.
We gave
a shot. It didn't work. You're paying people to not farm. Like, I don't know that that's a good idea. And I really don't blame the people themselves for taking it. You know, I could see people, you know, buying a home, like in that last example in that clip, you know, where they're going, wait, you're telling me if I buy this house, the government's going to pay me $20,000 a year? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, I really just, I don't blame them that much. I think it's just unfortunate, you know. I think it's sad that these things go through, and most people don't know about them.
And really, in that example, that you couldn't see the clip, but these were residential subdivisions that were on agriculturally zoned land. So they, you know, they just took advantage or were able to take advantage of, you know, zoning payments, essentially.
Wow. So it wasn't even farmable land.
But it
and
was.
See, that's where the expiration would help, too, because exactly. If you have to go back in and go, this area isn't, you know, there's no farm here. Yeah. Like, it's residential. I mean, there's a garden in the back, but I don't think we need to, you know, subsidize this 10 by 10 garden.
Yeah, and I think that's what Stossel was trying to, you know, he was trying to convey is the fact that, you know, this happens, you know, where you're at, Kirk, all the time in Chaska, where you have densely populated residential subdivisions that are constructed on what used to be agricultural property, right?
And that's yep. And it's rezoned, yeah.
Well, in this case, it wasn't rezoned. Well, as far as the Department of Agriculture is concerned, it wasn't rezoned. So they're selling, lots on and pieces of property that are still zoned as ag rather than residential, which, you know, that's just that is something that would be addressed by revisiting legislation every X amount of years.
I'd imagine that there'd be something along the lines of like a minimum acreage or something like that for something like that to be any real.
Well, the couple of the homes were in that clip were a couple acres, but they were residential acreage. It was residential acreage. It wasn't agricultural.
Okay.
So that you can bypass that. Like the larger home that was outlined in that clip was probably a couple million-dollar house. So the house is probably 7,000 square feet on a couple of acres, but it was, you know, lawn, basically.
I'd fully support what you're talking about as far as sunsetting. I think we should go one step further and sunset every law that's already on the books, like 4 years from now, and then they have to redo everything.
Well, I mean, you would have to like, make the expirations. You know, you'd have to stagger them out to a certain degree, just for practicality's sake. I mean. You know, our Congress couldn't go through absolutely every single law in the books, but then it might make them think twice about passing law after law after law after law once they had to address every single law that's out there and really come to terms with how many laws are actually on our books.
I think, and then we criminalize trying to leave the legislative session.
Yeah, there we go. So every time they pass a law, they really think, oh, okay, is this going to be worth it? Because I'm going to have to be stuck in a room re-debating this, you know, 4 years from now.
Yeah. There's definite, I mean, there's a definite need in more efficient legislation than what's in place now. All right, I'll continue on with this clip. There's another couple minutes left, and we'll move on.
Of course, it is true that without subsidies, some bureaucrats would be out of work, and some farms would go out of business. But that's okay, say economists. It's part of the creative destruction that makes America strong.
When there's progress, certain jobs are destroyed, and certain jobs are created. The guy who delivered ice to my house, he doesn't have the job because we have refrigerators. We're better off. Now, the guy who lost his job selling ice, he probably got some other job. But we would have been held back if we had tried to save his job.
But today in America, politicians are eager to spend your money to keep certain auto companies afloat.
Loan guarantees that we've already passed for our auto industry.
Certain banks in business.
We must pass legislation to address this crisis.
And to keep farms from closing.
I think we might have to get two or three of these, don't you think?
Yeah.
There is one country that has abolished farm subsidies, New Zealand. There were riots and protests when they did that. Farmers said, we'll go bankrupt. People said, we'll starve. But it didn't happen. In fact, farm productivity quintupled.
Agriculture there has boomed once they got people off the dole. Instead of sucking up to you politicians, they found ways to be more efficient as farmers.
I don't have many farmers sucking up. I do have them coming in and thanking me for allowing their family farm to survive.
Clothing and shelter are important too. Why don't we subsidize them? If this works so well, why don't we just subsidize everything?
Well, I would say to you that you don't.
So, I never heard about New Zealand like that.
You know.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You know what they have a lot of, a lot of in New Zealand, Kirk?
Sheep,
golf,
hobbits.
A lot of
golf.
A lot of really good golf courses.
No,
I'm serious.
I've golfed there.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I did. It's the only time I've ever golfed on an ocean that I can recall.
But...
I know. I heard something about Peter Jackson and hobbits.
Hobbits.
Well, can any? This is my viewpoint on law. Any law passed is only a protection racket for sustaining society as it is. It's any tax dollar spent is taking money from someone and spending it how the government wants, deems necessary. There's unintended consequences to everything. So what you're doing is taking someone's savings, or not even savings at all, preventing them from, you know, living how what they need. They have to cut back their livelihoods to pay for the taxes, or else someone else is saving money and having to pay taxes in from that way. So that money is either exiting the economy and going to the government, and the government is siphoning it off, paying for their own well-being, and then putting it back, and it's going in just to protect certain interests. No matter any law is just a specific interest of trying to protect as is. And there's so many unintended consequences of what if could have happened if that money would have stayed in someone's hands in the first place. If it was savings that they took, that money would have been invested most likely. And if it's taken from someone else's that needs that money, it's preventing them from living their full life. So I don't understand how these laws, people argue all this law and subsidizing to protect things that I think that we need to look at what a law is, that it's purely trying to subsidize the current life you have today. And it's such a myopic viewpoint.
Well, I mean, that kind of goes to the point of, do we want to preserve things that have become antiquated? The idea that, you know, there's not the guy who, you know, goes from house to house providing ice, because now we have a refrigerator. The same thing. I mean, what happened to the guy that used to sell dot matrix printers? You know, are we crying for him? Are we sad that he's out of a job? No, we're not, because technology moves on, life moves on, we progress, and we come up with better ideas and new technologies, and the jobs change along with them. And so to try and perpetuate, you know, and sustain something that isn't necessary anymore isn't doing anyone any favors. And there will always be growing pains. Like, I get it. It sucks in that moment when that person loses their job. Anyone I've known that's ever lost a job, it's hard. I'm not going to say it's not difficult. But you move on and you find a way to apply your talents and your abilities in a new endeavor that's providing value to this new world. What do you guys think about that?
I mean, do you think, totally lost my train
of thought. I feel like we're wasting people's talents and abilities by continuing to employ them in ways, or pay them to not be employed in certain ways. You know, using them in a way that the world doesn't need them anymore, instead of applying them towards, I mean, there are so many goals and objectives that the human race hasn't accomplished yet. We haven't found, you know, the cure to cancer or the cure to poverty. There are so many ways in which these people can, you know, apply their talents and abilities and to the world and give them what they've got. So why are we continuing to use them in ways that they're not needed, when there are so many needs that are unmet at this point?
Yeah, it goes back to what I've talked about before, that it's disgusting that people go out there and vote for politicians to enact laws that only keep their lives at how it is. It's not looking to the future about the future generations. It's not a sustainable form. And it's just ridiculous that people think that they can go vote to protect their lives as is. And I find it disgusting. And the absence of the mindset of liberty in people, that to be able to limit that instinct that we all have. It's an instinct that is ingrained in self-interest, though.
I mean, there's something very natural and human about protecting your own interests. And
yes.
I can't fault people who have children that say, you know, I know my life's tough and I'm going to do everything I can to protect my family. And I'm not going to say, oh, they're a piece of shit because they're doing that. I wouldn't agree with that. But,
no, but it takes intellectual prowess to be able to defeat that. I mean, it's an intellectual concept to be able to – liberty is purely intellectual. It's the 5,000-year leap. I don't know if you guys have ever read this book, but I can't think of the author. But it's a concept that was invented. It was such a foreign idea in people. We, throughout the history of mankind, we all had rulers to rule over us and as a protection for us to live and certain cultures and society. It's an invention. Liberty is an invention. It's a mindset and it needs to be argued. And it's such a foreign concept in people's minds today that it's just disgusting.
It's Willard Cleon Skousen.
Have you guys ever read it?
I have it on my Kindle. I started it. I haven't gotten far.
It's a great book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, whether it's new or not, you know, we've had that opportunity for liberty. And unfortunately, you know, it hasn't been a perfect system. We can't expect it to be a perfect system. And we've seen a lot of corruption within our democracy in terms of what types of candidates are even allowed to be voted for. So all we can do is strive to be better, and all we can do is try and make better decisions. We can't, you know, throw people on the coals for, you know, not making every perfect decision. I know I haven't
made every perfect decision.
You know, but I think it's good to just maybe spread the word and remind people that there are other options out there and there are other ways of looking at things, and it's important to take, you know, voting seriously and understand it's a responsibility, and understanding that being part of a country where we're allowed to participate is a responsibility, not just an entitlement. And with that responsibility, we have to, you know, we have to take it seriously and we have to put some thought into it and really consider how our actions are not just affecting ourselves, but our neighbors and, you know, our communities.
Yeah, but the point about what I'm saying about the liberty aspect, the mindset, isn't to sit there and chastise people for their self-preservation, but at the same time, it's should be argued against, that people can argue for and against, and there's not the argument against very in the public sphere today. Very rarely, it's either Democrat, Republican, conservative, or liberal. We talked about net neutrality a couple months ago, and both parties were all for net neutrality at the time. And now that it's starting to come to be, the legislation's about to happen. It's blowing up all over Facebook and all over public spheres about, oh, get the hand government out of it. They're just going to screw everything up. And now it's turned into a Democrat-Republican thing. And that's just how everything is today, that every little issue, it just morphs into this Democrat-Republican two-party system. And it's
Do any of you guys know the origins of the subsidies for agriculture? I mean, I know what happened around the Depression. I just don't know a ton of details about exactly, you know, what platforms were used to get it to go through. Do you guys know?
I have a clip that kind of goes over that. It's a Learn Liberty clip on corn subsidies. But it does have to do a lot of the subsidies that are in place now have to do with circumstances around the Great Depression, because, I mean, there just wasn't a lot of output then. I mean, it was a very difficult time, both economically and agriculturally for almost a decade. I think I am off. Hold on a sec here.
I can still hear you.
Yep, you're all good. There was just a moment, but
I couldn't. Yeah, something happened. But that is a huge driver behind subsidies. And in talking about sunsetting, that potentially would, you know, take care of that, because a lot of subsidization law is archaic and, you know, 70, 80 years old at this point. And, you know, any good corporate interest will take advantage of loopholes or advantages within that legislation. So I'm going to roll this clip. And I'm pretty sure it does address what you're talking about, Chelsea. If it doesn't, then my bad. But I think it adds a little bit to the conversation.
Did you know that Coke used to be made with cane sugar in the U.S.? But in 1984, they switched to corn syrup. You might wonder why they made the change. They did it to save money. It turns out that sugar in the U.S. is about twice as expensive as it is in the rest of the world. But why is that? Well, it can be explained by a concept economists talk about a lot: concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. Let me explain. In 1982, President Reagan reimposed a quota on imported sugar. Quotas restrict the amount of a good that can be imported to the U.S., which reduces the supply of sugar and protects domestic producers from foreign competition. When you reduce the supply of sugar with a quota, the price rises. That's simple supply and demand economics. As a result, American consumers pay more for sugar and products that contain sugar than they would without a quota. A Commerce Department study estimated the cost of the quota to consumers at roughly $3 billion a year. So why would the government put a policy in place that hurts the majority of consumers and voters? Wouldn't that be political suicide? Actually, no. Because the $3 billion cost is very dispersed among the whole population of consumers, each of us individually pays only about $10 more on sugar products a year, so we don't even notice it. Most of us have no idea this quota even exists. And even if we do know about it, who's going to take the time to complain to the government or spend money to lobby to change the law? All that trouble over $10 a year? Meanwhile, the benefits of the quota are very concentrated. Between 1980 and 1998, each American sugar farmer made roughly $3 million a year extra as a result of the quota. So each of them is willing to spend a lot of time and money making sure the law stays that way. They sent lobbyists to D.C. to talk to politicians because they need the quota to...
On the call. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Whereas before you probably couldn't.
Well, it just got cut off like 5 seconds of silence there, if that, maybe only 2 or 3 seconds.
Yeah, I paused it and noticed that you were no longer on. What I was saying is that wasn't the clip I was thinking of. It's still good, and I cut it at 2 minutes. It's got about another minute and a half or so left. Unfortunately, I don't have notes for each one because I have like 8 or so open.
Where was that clip from again? If people want to listen to the whole thing,
Learn Liberty. You can just on YouTube. You can look it up. But I can play the rest of it. It's still applicable to the conversation. But
we're getting time down there.
One thing I'd just like to comment on is the reason why your soda tastes like crap compared to the way it used to is because of subsidies. So yeah, there's another reason.
1984 that happened. I think I didn't drink soda before I was 4 years old.
Yeah, have you ever had Mountain Dew Throwback?
No, but I've.
What about Pepsi Throwback?
Yeah.
I tried it. It's better.
It's good. And
it's actually the corn syrup, the high fructose corn syrup, is really bad for people, we're finding out.
Right, sugar is much better for you.
Right, and what we're finding, like what's crazy is like you can say, okay, maybe it costs you $10 a year more for your food, But what about the annual cost to our health care? Now, I probably shouldn't even mention it. That'll open a whole can of worms. But
no, but that's a good point. But then at the same time, why do we have to pay that $10 more, right?
Right, that
shouldn't even be necessary.
Because
I mean, it's a voluntary choice.
It's the subsidies causing that, though.
Like,
the subsidies cause that.
Right. No, I'm not saying that it's acceptable by any means, but I'm saying that we should consider all the costs, not just the like upfront costs. But
You're saying government's short-sighted?
wait. What do you mean government being short-sighted? That's never happened before.
Conversation is over.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I think that even, you know, it was quite obvious, you know, what her opinion on the matter was, but even so, understanding that she was underestimating the total cost to us, you know, every single year, when you come to factor in, you know, the additional health costs and tragedies associated with it. But yeah, the sunsetting would definitely apply to a situation like this. I mean, if the public was aware, like, okay, we have to talk about whether or not we want to subsidize these super rich, you know, sugar farmers, the public might go, what? Why are we spending money on that? Like, I just see it as a way that it would force some of these issues, to the front of people's minds and, you know, maybe help them understand where their tax dollars are going a little bit more.
I agree.
A little transparency.
Oh. There's only a minute and a half left in this. Since I started it, I'll play it out and we can move forward.
Sounds good.
Protect them from foreign competition. If the quota were removed, they would lose a lot of money. And some of them might even go out of business. So from a lawmaker's perspective, you have one side giving you all the reasons why the policy is so important, arguing we need the jobs or the industry or whatever their case is, and you have another side that hardly speaks up at all. Which way are you going to vote? It's pretty obvious. Concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. This simple concept explains so much of the policymaking and money spending that goes on in Washington. So what can we do to improve accountability and get rid of wasteful spending? Unfortunately, as long as we allow government to make policies that only benefit a certain group, that special interest will have a big incentive to get involved in politics. If we don't want large agribusinesses and other big corporations lobbying for these benefits, the only real answer is to limit what the government can do. More regulation or oversight won't fix the problem.
Sunsetting helps with that.
Yeah. You know, and it is unfortunate. It's something I've tried to figure out, and I haven't come up with any, you know, good alternatives in terms of, you know, creating more accountability for government spending when there is something that is not really big for me or you as individuals, but in aggregate is a big deal. Especially when we're running deficit after deficit after deficit and we're going, talking about cutting funding to programs that are absolutely necessary, like human services, as opposed to, like, giving away free money to people who don't need it, you know. Sunsetting would maybe help make those hypocrisies more evident, you know, because then it forces us to have the discussion about how we want to spend our money and whether they're valid reasons and valid venues for those expenditures.
Well, I think it goes into how, as a culture, people just want to live in cities pretty much. I find it.
I disagree. No, I wouldn't.
What do you mean? Look at, we played a clip earlier that everyone, all these farm towns are just being diminished in size.
Yeah, well,
everyone lives in the cities.
People wanting to live in a city. The only reason,
but people do, let me go into my point of why I brought this up.
I want to move out to the country as soon as this lease is over. And I know my parents would never live in the cities. I know many people who do not want to live in the city, so I don't think that's an accurate statement.
Well, you as an individual, this does not apply to you then. But the majority of people enjoy living in cities because of the convenience. And it comes with a cost. It comes with subsidies. It comes with these huge, huge conglomerates of corporations that produce the food. Why?
Like, why would someone living in a city necessarily require subsidies? I mean, that I don't see how those two are related.
Because it's the ease of products. It's the loss of jobs because of the huge corporations that do the farming that squeeze out the little guy. And here's where I'm leaning to.
You find more mom and pop shops than you do in the suburbs. You know, that's one thing I do like about living in the cities is that in the suburbs you get all the Ruby Tuesdays and all of the chains and all the Starbucks. But whether you're in a small town or
the suburbs is still the city is my characteristics.
No, they're different. They're different. There's suburbia, there's urban, suburban, and then there's rural. And in rural areas and in urban areas, you tend to find more independently owned.
Hold on a second.
Whereas in
hey, stop Chelsea real quick. Stop. I think it dropped.
I'm back.
All right, he's back.
We're good.
All right. But you tend to find more of that mass produced, you know, chain restaurants and
yes,
blah, blah, blah.
Because of a thing suburban, called zoning.
Not urban areas, not rural areas.
All right, there's government sets. Am I on mute?
No, I can hear you.
I muted you a long time ago.
The government sets up zoning.
It's so clear.
So that's why everyone's lumped up into a little thing, and that's in the suburbans, people that want to get out of the city, but they still have their jobs and are on the bubble of the city, and everyone funnels into the city, and technology is changing this, yes. But because of zoning that we talked about earlier, that I don't think zoning should exist in the most part, very, very minuscule zoning regulation. But my point is I find it disgusting that you drive out to the farm sides or countrysides, and every farmland you see is completely homogeneous. There's not –
what do you mean?
It's all just one plant. To me, as you look at homogeneous. Yeah, well, whatever.
But I mean, to a certain point, you know, you have to, you know, increase efficiencies. And if they had, you know, 10 acres and there was 30 different types of plants, the cost of, you know, farming each one of those plants is going to increase dramatically because the harvesting is going to change dramatically. The types of fertilizer they're going to need and watering that they're going to need and sun that they're going to need is going to, you know, all be unique as opposed to applying the same type of care to a single plant. And one thing that they do is rotate crops, so I will give them credit for that. You know, it's not like they're planting the exact same plant year after year in perpetuity in the same spot, which, as we know, robs the soil of a specific type of nutrient that particular plant needs. So they are, you know,
crop rotation.
They are rotating crops. I mean, so there is that. But it's not realistic if you're going to feed the world to have, you know, 20 different crops in one area.
See, I totally disagree. Because
hold on, having some issues again. You guys there?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
It just sounded like you were opening a bottle.
All right. Let's go back to pre-Great Depression in the 1930s. Everyone was more spread out because of the downturn, because of the subsidies, the government intervention and everything. People started moving to the cities. That's why there was a thing called the Dust Bowl. Everyone just got up and left. Because of the Dust Bowl, because of the famine, I mean, the heat, whatever, the lack of rain.
Exactly what we were just talking about is it was a lack of crop rotation. They didn't understand the science, so they just continually produced corn, and corn ended up leaching all the nutrients that it needed out of the land, so they couldn't produce a crop anymore. So then the land was barren, and that allowed the dust storms to kick up, and that's why they called it the dust
storm. So society made a mistake, and what happened?
Right.
The government subsidized it.
Better.
to make it better. Yeah, bullshit. So, my point is, Chelsea, that if people spread out more and grow own foods, own communities, and self-sustain that way, that you have...
We're actually seeing that trend. So,
yes, we're coming back to it, but the government regulation and subsidizing and inflation upon us, that the whole government system is slowing that trend down. That just think,
but I mean, the fact that it's starting to emerge, despite the fact that the government is, you know, implementing subsidies and holding us down, the fact that we're still seeing this trend towards, you know, that's all derived from the people, it's actually really inspiring. The fact that this isn't something that's been pushed upon us, this isn't something that's required, it's something that people are wanting and seeking, and it's something that people are rewarding. You know, so you see these local meat markets that say, you know, we get our meat from, you know, local small farms, and, you know, we get our honey from local small farms. And you're starting to see a lot more of this. And you're even seeing restaurants based off of the idea that they want to, you know, rotate their menu based off of what's available in the local environment with small, you know, mom and pop farms. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, it wasn't required, and it's, like you said, has been, you know, pushed down by, you know, the subsidies on corn and the subsidies on that. And, you know, the government implementations of these programs have, you know, made it more difficult. But we're still seeing this great trend despite all that. And I think that's very promising. And it once again comes back to the individual decisions we make and how much power we really do have as a people despite what the government does.
Agreed. I agree with that. And this kind of... It's been a common theme in our discussions, I think, in general. It's the decentralization of activity in general. I think specifically over the last 5-10 years, you notice more of a focus on locally grown, locally sourced produce, protein, that type of thing, which there's no reason to believe won't continue. And that flies directly in the face of interests that are behind subsidization, which are large conglomerates, corporations that are interested in maximizing production in, you know, any given area. So you just plant corn, you get as much corn as possible. You plant wheat, you get as much wheat as possible. And at the expense of biodiversity. So you kind of see the two that are, you know, they're kind of butting heads, and the consumers are making a choice more and more, more interested in having, or, you know, healthy, somewhat organically grown product rather than interested in, you know, high fructose corn syrup types of products or GMO products or mass produced products. I think, you know, we can probably all, either in our personal decisions or we know people who route around the corporate interests. And I think that's a theme that could counterbalance a lot of the lobbied interests in kind of the agricultural space in general.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at, that most of all these farm subsidized products end up going into processed food, and it's not to the restaurants or the local eateries that it's a growing culture out there because people are waking up through technology and educating themselves. So the lack of nutrients that are out there and sick of feeling sluggish in themselves, and they go out there and find higher quality food. But
yeah,
my
wonderful.
Point is,
it's good.
It's not a what we have to do to the environment to produce these homogenous farmlands and to produce corn, GMO corn, and GMO crops with massive amounts of fertilizer.
Oh, hold on. It's going to be next time. So
yes, I'm just alluding to it. But
let's not give it all away.
Yeah, let's not give it away.
It is inspiring to see people wake up to that, and collectively we're making a difference despite all of the things that might be holding that down. And as technology grows and as our resources grow, we as individuals are changing the landscape despite what's happening in Washington, and that is something to celebrate.
It is.
And I completely agree. That's absolutely.
And it has, I think, especially in the, as you get younger and you have access to information online, you know, whereas 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, kids were interested in Little Debbie's or, you know, sweets or anything, you know, processed pizza, you know, whereas now, that's really not the case as much. Individuals, both young and old, understand that GMOs or processed food aren't good for you. And that goes against that lobby.
I would also say, Eric, I think, and this is my opinion, I don't know what you guys think, but I think that it's a lot more flavorful to go with something that's a non-GMO, a natural product, and a company that kind of embraces that whole philosophy. I'm willing to pay more when I go to a restaurant for a non-GMO and a natural philosophy just because the food does taste better.
I agree.
Tomatoes. Most restaurants use processed food.
They do. Well, most of them do, but I actually seek out the non-processed food restaurants because it tastes better.
Like,
the quality
is
superior.
Like where Chelsea lives, there are tons of restaurants that offer that type of choice. And people, you know, they would rather spend more money, maybe have a little bit less to spend on other things for food that's good for them, that tastes better, that's more interesting. And, you know, that's been a trend that's been growing exponentially over the last 5 to 10 years.
Right.
But we're being myopic and looking at ourselves that we're able to afford it. What about people that can't afford that?
No,
that
people
have to go out there.
Oh, no, you're right. You're right. No,
I mean, I don't think
it's reasonable. Those prices will be
not with subsidizing.
The more that we
and the
create
harm we're doing to the environment.
A minute. So the more we create a demand for that, the more that those options will grow, the cheaper they will become. Supply and demand, right? Like, I mean, it's gonna become more cost efficient the bigger the market is. You know, it just will. And while it is a privilege, unfortunately right now, hopefully it will become, with growing pressure and growing market opportunity, something that will be affordable in the future.
Chipotle.
I disagree because you will never find organic food cheaper than GMO food.
Oh, I think that's myopic, Kirk.
I do not.
I think you're very short-sighted.
Hey,
I think
every price is based upon what people are willing to spend. It's a luxury to buy that stuff. So that is
subsidized.
The mass-produced food.
We've been talking about subsidized.
Organic food is always going to be priced higher than that.
Not necessarily.
Yeah. So with that,
prove me wrong. I'd love to prove me wrong. Until the subsidized.
All right.
Down,
Kirk,
it will never be. You're telling me that.
All right. I hear you. However, we are hard up against our stop. We need to stop for the night. So, with that said,
can I just say one quick thing?
Eric, put your finger on the lone wolf button. We're gonna need it.
Okay, here we go. We got it. Go on, Kirk.
All right, farmland. There's no. I see more environmental life in a city, a downtown vicinity, than I would in a homogeneous farmland. It is the absence of life. Just because you see one field of plants doesn't mean that there's animal. Life, I mean, it's to me, they are cities out there in the farmland is these things. And I think the environmentalist movement would do greatly to fight those kind of things. And I think in the roots of environmentalist movement, you do find that, but not in the mainstream part of it. So, but there, to me, when you see a farm that's spread out, just one homogeneous crop,
homogeneous,
you might as well be looking at a skyscraper. taking up that piece of land. That's my lone wolf statement.
That's all right. Wolf.
Yeah, I was hoping we could end on a positive note.
Yeah.
And I do have, I'd like to, you know, you guys can tie on too. But I do see, you know, at least from a liberty perspective, it ties in with liberty perspective, the, you know, kind of the advent of the organic, locally sourced, locally destined type of agricultural economy as being something that will, it has and will become more and more important, because I think as far as a lot of people, if you skew younger, especially younger, they're willing to pay more for good food that's healthy for you, that tastes good, and maybe, you know, maybe lose some of the frivolous expenses, you know, like gadgets or, you know, higher end clothing or whatever, because they understand that you know, a healthy diet and good, you know, good tasting food is maybe a bit more important for them. So I think that's going to be a driving force against GMOs and, you know, like you're talking about, Kirk, homogenized type of agricultural strategy, and I think it's a positive.
Well, look at even what we've talked about before is the technology that really most of the stuff that we're talking, that you're talking, referencing, can actually be urban farmlands now. They can be made inside warehouses through aquaponics, hydroponics methods, and that is a lot of what the future is going to be. Is you're going to have a huge warehouse producing produce and vegetables and maybe some protein, types of protein products that will be produced locally and distributed through the local environment of a city, so, not even from a farmland.
So what you're saying is you agree.
That I agree? Oh, I wholeheartedly agree.
Okay.
I am not disputing right. Any of that you guys have said.
All right. Then on that note, I'm super freaking excited for next week when we're going to talk about GMOs, because this is something I've actually researched to a very large extent. I want to say thank you all for joining us. This has been Liberty Southwest Podcast number
33.
33. Adios, mofo.